My parents started building a new home right after they both retired. They were pretty hands-on with the construction at first, but it ended up taking much longer than they'd expected. By the summer, the house was only 3/4 finished. My parents had already booked a non-refundable cruise for most of July, so they asked me to check on the house while they were gone. On the first 2 days of their cruise, I just drove by the house. The construction people seemed hard at work, so I didn't bother getting out of my car. On the third day, I decided to take a closer look. I parked on the street and walked over to one of the construction workers. He was painting the shutters. I introduced myself as the son of his clients. He shook my hand, but he didn't seem too happy to meet me. I asked if I could take a quick look around.
"Go wherever you want," he grumbled. "But stay out of the basement. That's unfinished."
I gave him my word, but of course I was going to go into the basement. I'd promised my parents that I'd make sure the construction was continuing, so I needed to see every room. I didn't go there first, of course. The construction guy would have stopped me. So I started by walking around the house. Aside from some painting, the exterior seemed ready. Then I walked through the living room and kitchen. Everything looked good. I made sure that I was alone, and then I walked down into the unfinished basement. It was too dark to see at first. I clicked on the light, and I immediately gasped at what I saw. There were chains everywhere, a swing hanging from the ceiling, a circular bed on a rotating platform, shelves filled with all kinds of weird toys. There was even a life-sized, extremely realistic-looking doll lying face down on a bench. Oh, my parents were building a dungeon. There was no other explanation. Oh, no wonder the construction worker didn't want me to come down there. I very quickly rushed out of there, feeling really grossed out. As I hurried back to my car, the construction worker stopped me.
"You went into the basement, didn't you?" he asked.
I forced a smile. "Nope, I didn't see anything." The man looked at me for a long time, trying to figure out if he believed me. I guess he did, because he eventually turned around and went back to work. He didn't say anything else. I was about to drive home, vowing to never mention what I saw, when my phone rang. It was my parents checking in on the new house. I told them not to worry, everything looked fine. Unfortunately, my mom knew me better than anyone. She could tell that I was hiding something. All it took was one question before I blurted out, "I saw your dungeon!" My parents were silent for a long moment. Then Dad awkwardly asked, "Was it finished yet?"
"Yes," I said. "All your stuff was there."
"Including the swing?" Mom asked hopefully.
"Yes, the swing, all the shelves, even your life-size doll."
Silence again. And then Mom said, "Honey, we don't have any dolls." I couldn't believe I was having this conversation with my own parents. They didn't seem ashamed of their dungeon, but it was still really awkward. I wanted to change the subject, but Dad kept pushing me to describe the doll. So I did. It was male, with a very muscular build and sandy blonde hair. That's all I could see from across the basement.
"Oh my God," Mom said.
"Janie, you just described Gus, our lead contractor." I told her that I just talked to their lead contractor. In fact, I could see him outside my car window. He was still painting the shutters, occasionally glancing at me, and he looked nothing like the body I'd seen in the basement. I described him to my parents, and they said that they had no idea who that was. Mom urged me to call the police, but I figured this was all some misunderstanding. With my parents still on the phone, I got out of my car to approach the worker.
"Hey, excuse me, I'm on the phone with my parents right now."
The man froze in place. The paintbrush slipped out of his hand.
"What's your name?"
I asked him.
"I'm Gus," he said.
My mom's voice screamed through the phone.
"That's not Gus's voice! Janie, get out of there!"
Unfortunately, her voice was so loud that even though I wasn't on speakerphone, the man heard her too. He
He knew he'd been busted. Immediately, he dove at me and grabbed the phone out of my hand. Then, he chucked it against the wall, shattering it into pieces. He tried to grab my wrist, but I pushed him backwards and ran into the house. I locked the door behind me, but I knew that he'd find another way to get in. I had to find somewhere to hide. Once again, I ran down into the basement and locked the door behind me. Then, I positioned myself behind the swing and waited for him to try to come in. Gus's body was still lying face down behind me. Flies buzzed around it. I felt like such an idiot for thinking that it was a doll. Suddenly, I heard the man fumble with the doorknob. Then I heard his keys jingle. He unlocked the door and pushed it open. He slowly descended the stairs. "I told you not to come down here." He had a plank of wood in one hand. Just as he reached the bottom of the stairs, I pushed the swing as hard as I could. The metal chain slammed against him, knocking him backwards onto the steps. He was hurt, but not enough to stop him. I ran forward, jumped over him, and climbed the basement stairs. He'd stupidly left his keys in the door, so I locked him inside. Then I walked across the street and called the police. They arrested the man and collected the body. He's in custody now, but he still won't tell anyone who he is, or why he murdered poor Gus. My parents are supposed to come back tomorrow. I hope we'll all get some answers soon. At the very least, their house is now completely finished. They can use their gross little basement as much as they want.
Would appreciate if you could hit the like button before moving on to the next story.
I've always been the kind of person who dives headfirst into things. Call it stubbornness or a desire for independence, but I like to think of it as an adventurous spirit. That's probably why, despite being new to solo travel, I found myself checking into a hostel in a small town that had a reputation for being self-service. No staff after hours. It was cheap, had good reviews, and I was looking forward to the experience. But as soon as I stepped inside, the air felt thick with unease. The fluorescent lights flickered, and the silence was only interrupted by the occasional creak of the old building. I could feel the weight of something being off, but I shrugged it off. It was probably just nerves, first night jitters, I told myself. As I dragged my suitcase into the dimly lit hallway, I spotted him. A middle-aged man, shirtless, sitting on the couch in the common area. He looked up, his bloodshot eyes locking onto mine. I offered a polite nod, but he just stared back, his gaze too intense, too unsettling. The smell of alcohol wafted towards me, confirming what I had already expected. He was drunk. "Hey," I said, trying to sound casual. But he didn't respond. Instead, he just stared at me, his expression unreadable. The silence stretched on until it became unbearable, so I quickly made my way to the room, hoping to put some distance between us. We were the only two in the room that night. The uneasy feeling from before had morphed into full-blown anxiety, but I convinced myself to stay. I had already paid, and I didn't want to lose money over what was probably nothing more than an overactive imagination. I tried to sleep, but every time I closed my eyes, I could feel his presence, like a dark cloud hanging over me. The next morning, I was relieved to see someone else had checked in, a woman, around my age, from Sweden. We exchanged brief pleasantries, and I immediately felt a little more at ease. Maybe it was the company. Maybe it was just having someone else around to share the strange vibe of the place. But the man, he was still there, sitting shirtless in the corner, his eyes following us as we talked. He didn't say a word, just watched. It was unnerving, but I tried to brush it off. People are strange sometimes, especially in hostels. As night fell, the atmosphere grew heavier. The woman, her name was Anya, had turned in early. I stayed up, working on my laptop, trying to ignore the creeping dread that had settled in my stomach. And then he approached me. At first, I didn't even notice him until he was right beside me, holding his phone out towards me. The screen displayed a poorly translated note in English, asking me to talk downstairs, away from Anya. My heart started racing, but I tried to keep my cool. "What do you want?" I asked, my voice steady, but inside I was screaming at myself to leave, to run. "Just talk," he slurred, his words thick with alcohol. His breath reeked, and I could see the desperation in his eyes. I followed him downstairs, every step feeling like I was walking deeper into a nightmare. The common area was empty, the lights dimmed, casting eerie shadows on the walls. He gestured for me to sit, but I stayed standing, my back against the wall, ready to bolt if I had to. He started talking about the internet, how he wanted me to have a better connection for my work. But it didn't make sense. None of it did. The way he was looking at me, the way he kept glancing towards the stairs, it all felt wrong. "Cut the crap," I finally snapped, my patience wearing thin. "What do you really want?" He hesitated, his eyes shifting nervously, before he finally admitted it. He wanted me to stay downstairs so he could be alone with Anya. Anya, who was upstairs asleep, completely unaware of what was happening. Panic surged through me. I had to get out of there. But more importantly, I had to warn her. I didn't say another word to him. I just turned and ran upstairs, my heart pounding in my chest. When I reached the room, I shook Anya awake, my voice trembling as I told her what had happened. "We need to leave," I urged, grabbing my things and shoving them into my bag. She looked at me, her eyes wide with fear and confusion. The man had followed me upstairs, shouting that he had just made a mistake. But his words were empty, hollow, and I could see the darkness lurking behind his eyes. We didn't waste any time. We packed up our things and left the hostel, the man's desperate pleas echoing behind us. The cold night air hit us as we stepped outside, but it was a welcome relief. We found another place to stay, a small hotel a few blocks away. It wasn't much, but it was safe. The next morning, I reported the incident to the hostel's management and left a detailed review warning others about what had happened. For the rest of my trip, I couldn't shake the unease. Every hostel, every stranger, every shadow felt like a threat. The carefree excitement I had once felt about solo travel was replaced by a constant vigilance. But something else happened too. Anya and I, bonded by that terrifying night, became friends. We decided to stick together for the rest of our travels, and slowly, I began to feel that excitement return. I learned that it was okay to be cautious, to trust my instincts, and that not every situation would end in horror. Last year, my fiancé Jake took me to his family's cabin in the mountains. He shared it with his brother and cousins, but we scheduled a time in early December to have the place to ourselves. I was so excited. I grew up in the desert, so I'd literally never seen snow before. I'd always known that my fiancé was rich, but I didn't know that he was filthy, stinking rich until I saw that cabin. It was a modern two-story structure built along the slope of a mountain. It had its own servants' quarters. It had a sauna, two jacuzzis, and even a zip line, though that wasn't in use during the winter. This was literally the fanciest vacation house I'd ever seen, and Jake acted like it was some dump. "It's usually a lot prettier than this," he said. "We haven't had enough snow this season." The mountainside was still pretty snowy, but there were a lot of bare patches too. I still thought it was gorgeous. Jake took me inside, and we dropped off all our luggage in the upstairs bedroom. He explained that the master's bedroom was reserved for his globe-trekking brother Martin, the one member of his family I'd never met. From the way everyone talked about him, though, he seemed like a real weirdo. I was more than happy to stay out of his room. After we unpacked, Jake took me on a tour of the property. He said we'd just walk around the perimeter, but I had no idea that the property was so sprawling. 4 acres, though I don't know how much that is in feet or meters. Anyway, it was a lot of walking through the snow, and I didn't have the shoes for it. We reached the back corner of the property, the highest part elevation-wise. There was a huge, professionally made treehouse that he wanted to show me. "This is my favorite part of the whole mountain," Jake said proudly. "Come on!" He started climbing up the ladder, expecting me to follow him, when he suddenly stopped and jumped back onto the ground. Never mind. I'm cold. He charged back towards the cabin, and I followed. I should have asked him why he suddenly changed his mind, but that felt too awkward. I could tell he was hiding something, though. We spent the rest of the evening together, neither of us mentioning the treehouse. I couldn't stop thinking about it, though. So that night, after Jake had finally fallen asleep, I snuck out of bed, slipped on my boots and jacket, and left. The mountain was so much scarier at night, but this was my only chance to see for myself. If I'd left during the daytime, Jake would have noticed. I used my cell phone's flashlight and trudged through the snow. I almost slipped a few times on the rocks, but eventually, I reached the treehouse. If Jake was hiding something from me, it must have been in this spot. I looked around the treehouse, but didn't see anything suspicious. Then I started to climb up the hanging ladder, just like Jake had done before he rushed me back inside. I got about halfway up the tree when I was finally able to see what Jake had seen. There was a wide trough dug into the ground just past the treehouse. It wasn't visible until I climbed up high enough, but now I could look into it. I saw something horrible. Body parts. The pit was about a quarter filled with snow, and sticking out of the snow were arms and torsos and heads. It was a mass grave with a mixture of frozen corpses and full-on skeletons. Someone must have been using this death pit for decades. I was so shocked by what I saw that I lost my balance and fell backwards off the ladder. I would have landed hard on the icy ground, but someone caught me. Jake. He had followed me out here. He slowly lowered me onto my feet, his expression blank, but a little nervous too. I can explain. He stood between me and the house. He didn't look threatening, but he also didn't look like the man I fell in love with. Couldn't figure out why. Are you a killer? I asked him point blank. No, he answered. Martin is. Slowly and with deep shame, Jake told me that his entire family knew that his brother was a serial killer. They'd been ignoring it for years, just willfully turning a blind eye. Jake even admitted that he'd known about Martin's hiding spot, but he assumed all the bodies would be covered up by snow this time of year. Every word out of Jake's mouth horrified me. I could never look at him the same way again. Every single person in his family was an accessory to his brother's crimes. Why didn't Jake go to the police years ago? Why didn't anyone in his family? I pushed past Jake and walked back inside. I was about to dial 911, but he grabbed the phone out of my hand. Please, he said. Just talk to Martin, hear him out. Then you can call the cops. I reluctantly agreed. I doubted that there was anything his brother could say to justify his actions, but Jake seemed so adamant. I thought he would use my phone to call his brother up, but instead, he ran into Martin's bedroom. Was Martin here right now? Had Jake lied to me before? I waited outside the bedroom door. I could hear Jake and his brother talking on the other side. Jake begged Martin to talk to me, and Martin eventually gave in. I waited about a minute before the door reopened and Martin stepped out. But it wasn't Martin at all. It was Jake in a curly wig and an ill-fitting business suit. What are you doing? I asked.
I'm Martin, he said in an artificially low voice. Nice to finally meet you. You're real pretty.
He brushed the loose wig hair away from his face.
My brother is a lucky man.
Your name is Martin? I asked carefully. I didn't want to upset him. Who knew what he was capable of? He reached out to shake my hand.
Jake has told me so much about you. I'm sorry you found out about my hobby.
He was talking about the dead bodies in the ground. Then he started explaining why he liked to kill. He talked about how Jake always got angry with him. How his family all helped him control his urges. It was all completely unhinged. I didn't really listen. I pretended to, but as he talked, clearly believing that he was Martin, I inched toward the door. Then
When I was far enough away, I raced to the car and drove off, leaving him there. That was the last time I ever dated a rich person. They're all insane. But at least I got to see snow for the first time.
My boyfriend Robert booked us a really nice Airbnb for our anniversary. It was a ranch house just outside Palm Springs, and it was gorgeous. I'm not the biggest fan of desert environments, but I'm much more of a beach person myself. Robert seemed adamant that this would be the perfect spot, and I wasn't going to argue. The house itself wasn't that big, but the property was enormous. It even had a barn in the back, plus a winding nature trail that wrapped around most of the property. It was the kind of place that people would rent out for weddings or other big events. I don't know how Robert could afford it. A woman named Nadia helped us out. Her family owned the property. I got a good feeling about her first. She seemed pretty friendly. She actually looked a lot like me too. The same long brown hair, same body type, and even slightly raspy voice sounding. As she was giving us a tour, I noticed her and Robert were exchanging very conspiratorial looking glances. I asked them if they knew each other, but Robert assured me that they only communicated through the Airbnb messenger. I really didn't believe them, but I wasn't the suspicious type. I knew that they were hiding something, just didn't know what. Just in case, I asked Robert if I could borrow his phone to look at the Airbnb messages. He got extremely defensive and told me no. I didn't want to get into an argument so soon after we checked in, so I dropped the subject. We settled in and I started to unpack. I was putting away all my clothes in the bedroom closet when I realized that Robert was no longer in the room. I wasn't sure where he'd run off to. I checked the other rooms, but he wasn't there. Then I looked through the living room window and saw him outside with Nadia. They were just off the porch in the middle of a serious conversation, and it looked like they had no idea that I was watching them. I had to find out what they were talking about. I went to the window and hid just below it so I could hear them better. I couldn't make out full sentences, but I heard enough to know that they were planning something tonight in the barn. I almost started to hyperventilate. I knew that my boyfriend would never cheat on me, especially on our anniversary, but it sure seemed like he was. He came back inside pretty quickly after that, but I didn't say anything. We went to bed that night, and I only pretended to sleep. I just waited with my eyes closed. After about an hour, I felt the bed move. Robert was very quietly climbing out of the bed and sneaking toward the front door. I didn't move until I saw the front door close. Then I raced towards the window and stared out of the darkness. I saw Robert walking through the grass. He was heading straight toward the barn. Furious, I slid on my night shoes and went outside too. I could see lights inside the barn. As I got closer, I could hear Robert and Nadia's voices over some soft romantic music. I didn't bother trying to be quiet. I wanted them to hear me. The barn door was halfway open. I could see them together inside the barn, surrounded with hanging Christmas lights. The whole place looked really romantic. I was so angry that Robert was there with someone else on our anniversary. Just as I reached the barn door, Nadia came out. She was smiling, but the smile disappeared when she ran into me. You were supposed to be asleep, she said nervously. Are you sleeping with my boyfriend? I demanded. Of course not. Then what are you two doing in there? She wouldn't answer. I kept demanding to know what was going on, but she wouldn't even look me in the eyes. She just mumbled that she couldn't tell me. Things escalated pretty quickly after that. I shoved her and she fell into the dirt. She jumped up and slammed her elbow into me. It was the craziest fight I'd gotten into my life, but I'd never felt one like this. I'd never been this angry. This woman was sleeping with my boyfriend, even though she knew it was our anniversary. And now she was biting me instead of apologizing. She just tripped me onto the ground and was about to kick me in the side. But before she could do that, I grabbed her foot and twisted it. She lost her balance and fell. Then there was this horrible crunch. In the fall, her head slammed against a tree stump. Blood fell out of both her eyes, and her tongue flopped out of her mouth. She was dead. Finally, Robert came out of the barn. He saw me and gasped. When he saw Nadia's dead body, he literally couldn't breathe. He started to have a panic attack. "It wasn't my fault," I said. "We were fighting and she fell." Robert looked at Nadia's bloody face. This did not look like an accident. "Why were you fighting?" he asked. "Because I found out that you two were sleeping together." His shock at my answer was enough to pull him out of his panic attack. He said that I misunderstood everything. Then he demanded that I follow him into the barn. I was afraid of what he would do to me after finding his mistress dead, but I didn't have any other choice. I followed him into the barn. The whole place was beautifully decorated. It looked like the barn from a Hallmark movie. Nadia was helping me decorate this place, so it would be perfect for our anniversary tomorrow. "For when I do this," he got down on one knee. "You're going to propose?" I screamed. "That was the plan, until you murdered the party planner." The reality of everything finally sank in. There was a dead body at our Airbnb. Even though I didn't mean to murder her, she was still dead. Her corpse was right outside the barn. The poor victim of a misunderstanding. "What are we going to do?" I asked. "It depends on your answer to my proposal," he answered. His face was blank. For a second, I didn't understand what he wanted me to say. I stepped forward and told him, "Yes, Robert, I'd love to marry you." "Then I'll gladly help you bury the body and make up an alibi." With the Christmas light shining all around us, Robert wrapped his arms around me and gave me the best kiss of my life. We could have held each other forever, but we had a body to bury. This whole experience happened 5 years ago. Robert and I have been married ever since, and Nadia's body was never found.
Last summer, I went to stay with my aunt and uncle in Colorado. They lived in this beautiful cabin up in the mountains. Growing up, I was always close to my Aunt Joyce. I always saw her as the fun aunt, the one who let me watch scary movies, even though my mom told her not to. When I was growing up, I saw Aunt Joyce a lot, but then she married her second husband Michael and moved away to Colorado. After that, I only saw her a couple of times, and things just weren't the same. Michael was super religious, and it felt like some of his beliefs were brushing off on her. She stopped being fun. I came out to the family 2 years ago, and Joyce was the only relative who didn't say anything. Everyone else showed their support, but Joyce just ignored my texts. I worried that her and Michael would cut me out of their lives since I was gay. But then, last summer, she called me out of nowhere and asked if I wanted to come up and stay with them for a few weeks. When I got there, Aunt Joyce gave me a big hug and said she loved me. It felt like she was back to being her old self. Uncle Michael shook my hand and gave me a tour of the house. He seemed stern, as always, but he was also pretty welcoming. Right away, I knew that this was going to be a good trip. I'd finally reconnect with my fun aunt. We stayed in the cabin for a couple of days, catching up and playing board games. Aunt Joyce asked me about my life, and I told her all about school. I even mentioned my boyfriend Miguel. She said she was happy for me, and she even asked to see his photos. I was so happy that she approved. On the third day, though, something terrible happened. Uncle Michael was outside on the porch. I didn't know what he was doing, but he tripped and fell over the railing. I was the first one to see him, and I almost threw up. His leg was twisted at an awful angle, and there was blood everywhere. I ran inside to get Aunt Joyce. She raced to him while I stayed behind. I could hear her scream, and then Uncle Michael started saying these awful things. "I knew we shouldn't have invited him. God is punishing us." Stuff like that. Aunt Joyce helped me get him into the car, and they drove to the hospital. They didn't even say goodbye. So that's how I ended up being home alone at my aunt's house. I didn't have a car to go anywhere, and when I tried to call Joyce on my cell, she didn't answer. I didn't know what to do. I figured they'd call me to fill me in, but I didn't hear from them all day. By nighttime, I was still there, alone. I waited. The cabin had seemed so welcoming and comfortable before, but by myself, I started to notice all the weird decorations on the walls. They had crosses and framed Bible passages, which weren't too strange. But they also had these really bloody figurines of Jesus and some other saints that had been blinded and stuck with spears and stuff. And when I took the time to read the Bible passages on the wall, they were all about hell and damnation. At 11, I finally got a call from Aunt Joyce. Her voice sounded shaky and she said, "We made a grave mistake. Please stay there. Don't leave. Our friends will come soon." Before I could reply, she hung up. I had no idea what she meant. Clearly, she was worried about her husband, but she really sounded unhinged. By midnight, I heard a car park right outside. I went to the window and realized that it wasn't just one car, it was five. At least a dozen people came out, all wearing suits and dresses, church clothes. These were the friends that Joyce had mentioned. They all walked to the front door, and their faces were really serious. I knew that Aunt Joyce would have wanted me to go outside and let them in, but I got a really weird feeling about this. They did not look friendly at all. They looked like they were on a mission. That's when I realized that Joyce and her husband had gone against their church's beliefs when they invited me into their house. And they believed my presence here was the reason that Michael got hurt. I wasn't even close to him when he fell. I guess they just saw it as a sign from God. I had no idea what their church friends were planning to do to me, but it couldn't be good. I ran to the front of the house and made sure the door was locked, and then I looked around for a place to hide. I ended up finding a small closet under the stairs. The door was only about 4 feet tall, but the space was big enough for me to fit inside. I crawled into the tiny closet and closed the door. I waited as quietly as I could as Aunt Joyce's church friends unlocked the front door and came inside. I could hear them whispering to each other. I could hear their plodding footsteps. "It's all right, son," one of the men called out. "Come out. We aren't here to hurt you. We just want to help." I could tell by his voice that I couldn't trust him. I waited for the longest time as the people searched through the entire cabin. I could hear them open doors and toss things around. One woman said, "He might have run into the woods." And then another woman said, "No, he's still here." I covered my mouth so they wouldn't hear me, but it was hard to keep quiet. My heart was pounding and I could barely breathe. And then, someone grabbed the door and pulled it open. It was an older, bald man. He looked down at me and smiled coldly. "Everyone, I found him. Come here." He reached down to grab me, but I pushed my way past him and ran into the living room. A few more of his church friends tried to grab me, but I shoved them off and ran out the front door. I saw all their cars parked in front of the house. I hoped that one of them still had the keys inside. I tried the first car, but it was locked. The second one was too, then the third. I knew that it was hopeless. I couldn't use any of these cars, and I couldn't just run into the woods. We were miles away from any other houses, and I had no idea what direction to go. I was trapped here. But just in case, I tried one more car, and I gasped. The door wasn't locked, and the driver had left the key sitting on the passenger seat. By then, all the church members were racing toward me. I didn't have any time to wait. I jumped into the car and stuck the key in the ignition. In seconds, I was backing down the driveway. Several people were pounding on the windows. The bald man who had found me first in my hiding place screamed, "Where are you going? We were just going to take you to the hospital." But I didn't believe that for a second. I kept driving. Soon, I'd pulled onto the main road and was speeding back toward the city. I ended up driving to the police station where I told an officer what had happened. He acted sympathetic, and he told me that I wasn't hurt and no crime had been committed except for the vehicle I stole. I couldn't believe it. He was siding with my aunt's crazy church friends. That's when I noticed that he had a Bible sitting on his desk. He said he'd call my aunt, but if the car's owner decided to press charges, he'd arrest me. A few minutes later, Aunt Joyce rushed into the station. Her expression was blank, but she wouldn't look me in the eyes. I asked her if she'd sent her friends to hurt me, and she said no. They were just trying to help. And how were they going to help? I asked. She didn't have an answer to that. "Look," I told her, There's a train station a few blocks away. If you just let me go, I promise to never visit you again. Okay, she said. And that's it. I left. I never found out how bad Uncle Michael's injuries were. I never found out what Joyce's friends were planning to do to me. After that day, no one in my family ever heard from her or her husband again.